from the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, husband, and homeschool dad. We have a great lineup of guests today, and we're going to be talking about things like the Department of Defense and their transgender policy, what the GOP faces in upcoming midterm elections, as well as a bill in the state of Oklahoma that would put the national motto in every school in the state. Last weekend, the Trump administration announced a policy shift in the military concerning transgendered individuals serving in the military. Joining Family Research Council President Tony Perkins to talk about it is Congressman Steve Russell of Oklahoma.
Colonel, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. It's good to be back with you.
Well, I'm certain you're probably enjoying some time back in your district as Congress is in recess this week. And so I first want to thank you for taking time to join us. But I know this is an issue that's of importance to you because you have served in Iraq and in battlefields in faraway places, defending the values, defending freedom, and defending what America stands for. And you understand the importance of the policies that surround our military.
Well, I certainly do, and it was interesting in Secretary Mattis's letter to the president, which was based upon a pretty thorough examination of this issue. It wasn't taken lightly. It was an issue that was thrust upon the military by the previous administration. And one of the important things to note in the letter to the president by Secretary Mattis, he just said that the department finds that exempting such persons from well-established mental health, physical health, and sex-based standards, which apply to all service members, could undermine the readiness, disrupt unit cohesion, and impose an unreasonable burden on the military that is not conducive to military effectiveness and lethality. And that is certainly a true statement. Much of, I guess, part of the discussion that we've had in Washington is that they were basing so much of this on a RAND study that was not only incomplete, but glossed over a lot of the data, which Secretary Mattis points out in his letter to the president. And we all were really kind of taken aback. It's like, okay, you're making all of these claims and you're imposing a policy on the way out the door, and yet we've not had any hearings, we've not had any studies, we've not had anything. And I pointed out, Tony, in last year's National Defense Authorization hearings, when we were doing the actual authorization, I just read the U.S. Army's guidance to commanders that was in draft form that was in anticipation if this policy became permanent. And it was coaching commanders on how they should deal with male pregnancies, how they should deal with members of the military with mixed genitalia that would be sharing showers with service members. And it was these are just bizarre things that you would really have to be completely removed from reality to think that that would not have a cohesion and a unit readiness impact. And so I really applaud Secretary Mattis for taking the deliberate route on this issue. And I think the president, in looking at his recommendations, made a wise choice.
And Congressman, it appears, going back to the president's initial kind of announcement via tweet back in August of last year, this is a slight modification of his statement there, in that those who came out under the policy as transgender, they will be able to stay in the military under certain conditions. Number one, that they're stable, that they are not having issues, that they're able to be deployed. So it is what you could say, what some could argue on the left, that it's fair. It treats those who came out under the government saying, okay, you can be transgender now, and if they did that, they will be treated fairly and can stay in the military. However, when it comes to recruiting, it comes to paying for surgeries and so on and so forth, that's not going to happen.
Well, it certainly looks at kind of a body of soldiery that might be caught in some type of a limbo. However, it's pretty specific on the things that would impact readiness, on the things that would impact behavioral health, and these items mentioned earlier. As far as cohesion and other things go, so it does provide some for a for a change, some pretty clear, specific guidelines. And I think the letter that that Secretary Mattis penned to the president provides the clarity that the military needed.
In Congressman, I want to go a little bit broader when we talk about the previous policies of the administration, not just the social policies, but, you know, sequestration. You and I talked about that a number of times, that was really hollowing out our military. I know many conservatives did not support, and I wasn't a fan of the omnibus spending bill, but it did increase military.
I didn't vote for it either, which was a tough situation.
It was for those like yourself and other members of the Freedom Caucus, myself being a supporter of the military. We are seeing our military focus on. However, I don't think it should be a trade-off to fund our military, which is an essential and
precisely.
Increase other domestic spending, which is non-essential. But our military is, under this administration, on a track to regaining its strength and being prepared to fight America's wars, if needed.
It certainly is, but we almost have to look at it like an anemic patient who has now gotten a bit of an infusion. That doesn't mean that the patient is as well or to full strength capacity. Although this military funding has been touted as the largest increase, and all of this, the reality is this actual spending is still 20% less than what it was in 2010, and so we have a lot of work to do still, and many struggled with the omnibus because. They realized with North Korea going on and with Syrian operations, being solidified with some unrest in Africa, with the ongoing operations in Afghanistan, with the European Defense Initiative in NATO, with so many things that are on the plate and the reset of the Cold War, thanks to the last administration. Now, here we are with this reality that we were weak. And to Congress's credit, in a bipartisan fashion, on the military pieces, they at least recognized that and came to an agreement. So what sadly we've seen, although we thought with the budget agreement that we did a month ago that we were going to break out of this sequester where it's a dollar-for-dollar trade-off, the reality is, yes, we got our budget guarantee for the military, and then we just larded it up with all of this other stuff in negotiations, which caused even the most ardent defense hawk supporters, such as myself, to have to vote against it just on grounds of good constitutional government.
And I applaud you for that, Stan. Let me ask you this, going beyond the issue as you talk about having to rebuild, it's going to take time to rebuild our military, and one is material. Obviously, that's a very important aspect of our nation's military. We've got the morale, removing the emphasis off of this social programming that was the only thing that seemed to be of interest to the previous administration.
Right.
But under 8 years, 8 years is a long time. I mean, when you consider that the average military career, well, I say those that retire 20 years, I mean, that's almost half a career, okay? In that time period, there we saw a lot of good people leave the military, a lot of officers pushed out, just couldn't take the new policies. Do we need to see this administration to rebuild the warrior mentality that is needed in our military? Do we need some of these retired officers to be brought back in?
Well, I think in any time, all we really have, Tony, on that to examine is periods of great national duress where historically we could see that you have seen officers recalled in time of national emergency if it requires the full weight and might of the nation to be mobilized, and I don't think that we would have an exception should we get into something like a ground war in North Korea, which would not be anybody's desire. There's obviously you would tap back into any experience that you could. But moving forward, I think we're on a right path here to get the military restored. And I hope people continue to support the policies of the president in that regard. He has kept his promise, and I think most Americans want that type of security. We need to do it. And it is, as you had framed up beginning today's show, you know, we certainly have concerns about whether or not the gavel would pass from Republicans to Democrats. Were that to happen, you think you've got problems now? Well, okay. This is the same group of leaders that declared, you know, war is lost and wanted precipitous pullouts that had great cost and blood and treasure later, like we saw in Iraq. And then these are people that, you know, if given leadership post again, would not be the military's friends. So we can't be under any illusions when people somehow feel disgruntled for whatever reason they might have disgruntlement.
Yeah, excellent point, and one that I will talk with Chris Wilson about. And before we're about to run out of time, but to that point, I mean, in a year's time, we've seen ISIS, you know, be, you know, that was on the ascendancy continually under the Obama administration, basically to be almost wiped out because of the rules of engagement and the military leaders being allowed to do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, and that clarity has allowed field commanders to go right to it. And knowing they have the backing of the president and of the leaders over them, all the way up through the Secretary of Defense, has really translated to making good, sound, and moral battlefield decisions that allowed the defeat of enemies.
Congressman Steve Russell, as always, great to talk with you. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks, Tony.
If you want to find out more about Congressman Russell, head over to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links. Also, I want to invite you to be a part of keeping Washington Watch on the air by going to TonyPerkins.com and making a tax-deductible contribution. Again, that's TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with a look at the upcoming midterm elections.
Where is our country headed? Are we moving in the right direction? Mark your calendar for the Values Voter Summit on September 21st to 23rd in Washington, D.C., and join hundreds of Americans that want a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Past speakers include President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, House Speaker Paul Ryan, Kirk Cameron, Kellyanne Conway, Secretary Ben Carson, and Sean Hannity. Don't miss the early bird price of $99 at valuesvotersummit.org.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. With little to motivate Republicans to get out and vote in November, Tony invited the Chief Executive Officer of WPA Intelligence, Chris Wilson, to talk about what the GOP needs to do between now and the election to retain active support among conservatives. Here's Tony Perkins.
Chris, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, you bet. Thanks for having me on.
All right, let me just jump right into it, because I know you've been giving some thought to this. You've written about it. What does the GOP need to do between now and the election to shore up their support among those conservative voters that put them in charge last November?
Well, you know, they could start by passing some conservative legislation. I think that's probably number one. It is. I am firmly in the belief that 2018 is going to be a turnout election, and Democrats have more than adequately demonstrated that they are motivated and they're turning out in special elections. And so the left is motivated by the fact that they hate Donald Trump. They hate Republicans. They hate people who think the way that we think. And they believe that the 2016 election was stolen from Hillary Clinton and stolen from Chuck Schumer and stolen from Nancy Pelosi, and they should be in charge. And right now they're motivated. They're motivated in the same way that we were motivated whenever Barack Obama was president. This is what happens whenever a party takes over the White House. The challenge that Republicans have right now is the right is not motivated. And they've gotten a few crumbs along the way, tax cuts, child education accounts, and some small reforms here and there. But when it gets down to it, there's nothing there. Obamacare is still intact. There's a budget that was just passed that funds Planned Parenthood, and conservatives, not Republicans in general, but it really runs across the party, do not have the same motivation that they did in 2016. Hillary Clinton is not going to be on the ballot. Barack Obama is not sitting in the White House. And so if Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan want to keep their majorities in the House and Senate, then they have got to take action between now and November and do more for the conservative base that got them elected. Because I got to tell you, if they don't, those conservatives are going to stay home. And it is, I mean, I can tell you from a state-by-state basis, you know, my background and what I do is analytics. and from Texas, where there are a little over 2 million turnout voters, to Nevada, where there's about a couple hundred thousand turnout voters. And what I mean by turnout voters are voters who wouldn't necessarily, Republicans, people who will vote Republican if they turn out, who are not going to vote in the off-year election without some additional level of motivation. And it's a real challenge because it could cost us 40 to 50 seats in the House, and it could keep us from picking up seats in the Senate. I don't think we ultimately lose seats in the Senate, but we are in a situation that right now Republicans could, there are 10 United States Democrat senators up that have to run for re-election in states that Donald Trump won. And each one of those should be a turnout, should be a pickup opportunity for Republicans. But
well, let me ask you about that, Chris, because there is, when you go back to the 2016 election, in many ways the Republican Congress rode the coattails of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the one that really enthused, engaged voters. All right, now I'm going to take a little issue with you here on what's happened. I would agree that Congress has done very little. They have not repealed Obamacare. But when you look at what Trump has done within his ability, I think he's actually delivered on more of his promises. I mean, look, let's start with Neil Gorsuch, a Supreme Court justice, a record number of appellate court judges that he has nominated and have been confirmed. I can go down to a new department within HHS that protects religious freedom and rights of conscience. Mm-hmm. Religious freedom executive order. Would we like to see it statutorily done? Absolutely. Look at moving the embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. First president in a quarter of a century, even though that's been the law. So there.
No, that's right.
Let me ask you this. So can voters distinguish between the accomplishments of Donald Trump and a Congress that has done less than stellar in the opportunity they've been given?
It's not an easy thing to do, and you and I actually don't disagree on anything you just said. I think the difference is, and where I would come down, is Donald Trump is not going to be on the ballot in 2018. And that's going to be the problem for Republicans, is they have got to motivate voters to turn out and re-elect a Republican House and Republican Senate that right now, in the minds of conservatives, has not delivered on the promises that were made. You're exactly right that Donald Trump has delivered on every single one of those promises that you just put forth. But in some cases, he's actually had to do it over the Republicans in Congress.
Right, right.
In most cases. And I think that's a real challenge for Republican majorities in the House and Senate. And it is, I think, the biggest problem right now, particularly for people who make up our base, is this budget bill that was just signed into law. I mean, the fact that it funds Planned Parenthood is just, it's unconscionable to me that we could have, how many election cycles, Tony, have we run in which you've seen Republicans at all levels running ads about defunding Planned Parenthood? Certainly in the last cycle, after tapes came out of, what they were doing with Planned Parenthood was doing with aborted fetuses, and that we still move forward and fund it at the level we did, and we being Republicans, that makes me angry as somebody who works to re-elect Republicans.
Yeah. To put it in context, it was the vice president, when he was a member of Congress, that passed the first bill out of Congress to defund Planned Parenthood. So, it's been going on for a long time, and I believe you're absolutely right. People should expect more out of this Congress, but my concern is if we lose Congress, or I should say we, if the Republicans lose Congress, I think the president and his agenda is in grave jeopardy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely no question. If Republicans lose Congress, I mean, this is by no means am I suggesting that Republicans should not turn out and punish the House and Senate, because that would be devastating. I mean, what you would look at, just to take the last issue we talked, funding for Planned Parenthood would increase even more. And you can go through issue by issue.
Oh,
I mean, you can without millions
Chris,
of illegal
Chris,
sold in a
Chris, we're up against a break. We'll get you back on more, because this is something we're going to talk about a lot in the months ahead.
If you want to find out more about Chris Wilson, just head on over to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links. Also, a quick reminder that your generous contributions to Family Research Council enables us to continue making these programs available, and you can donate when you visit TonyPerkins.com. We'll be right back with a bold statement by one Oklahoma lawmaker.
Most people remember Frederick Douglass as a fiery speaker who denounced slavery and advocated for the civil rights of African Americans and women. What is less known is Douglass's commitment to faith and family. The month of February marked the bicentennial of Frederick Douglass's birth, so it is a fitting time to reflect on the legacy of this great author, scholar, humanitarian, and entrepreneur who served five United States presidents. In an exclusive Family Research Council speaker series event, Reverend Dean Nelson, chairman of the board for the Frederick Douglass Foundation, and Colin Hanna, president of Let Freedom Ring, explore the life of Douglass as a Christian minister, a husband, and a father, and examine how his legacy can be an example for Christian citizenship today. To view this important event, go to frc.org/Douglass. Again, that is frc.org/Douglass.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Atheists continue to lock horns with municipalities around the country, afraid that American citizens may see biblical statements. But in the state of Oklahoma, at least one lawmaker is trying to reverse that trend. State Representative Susan Lynn joins Tony to highlight a bill she sponsored requiring public schools to post the national motto. Here's Tony Perkins.
Susan, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, thank you very much.
Give our listeners specifically, what does House Bill 2368 require schools in Tennessee to do?
It will require schools in Tennessee to post the nation's national motto, "In God We Trust," in a public common area in the school where all the students can see it. And I could not be more thrilled that this bill is passed. I think it's long overdue, and it's quite appropriate.
Now, let me just ask you this, Representative Lynn. What kind of motivated you and your colleagues to follow what several other states have done? But what was the motivation here?
I'll tell you, we receive a lot of emails from wonderful organizations, and I really thank God that they take time to write us. Some of the organizations are very liberal, but some are very conservative, and they are family-oriented organizations. And one is the Congressional Prayer Caucus, and they sent out an email last fall talking about the national motto bill, and they had model legislation. And I looked at that, and I thought, I'm going to file that. I think this is wonderful. And it was to put "In God We Trust" in our nation's school. And we have passed this bill, and the governor should be signing it either this week or next week. And I do hope to have a public bill signing with him as well. But it should be very shortly in our state school.
And this is the same motto that stands above the head etched in the marble of the House Speaker in Washington, D.C. In fact, last month I opened the Congress in prayer, and above me were the words, "In God We Trust," the nation's motto. So this is really nothing radical. It's just returning to an understanding of what we in the past have recognized, that we are, in fact, a nation that trusts in God.
Absolutely. In fact, in my research, I picked out two quotes that I really love, and one is Ronald Reagan. He said, "Our nation's motto, 'In God We Trust,' was not chosen lightly. It reflects a basic recognition that there is a divine authority in the universe to which this nation owes homage." Isn't that just true? And it is a recognition. And it's not an endorsement of religion. It is a recognition. And that is very important for children in their formative years to recognize that there is a divine authority. And then also, John F. Kennedy said, "The guiding principle of this nation has been, is now, and ever shall be, 'In God We Trust.'" He said that in 1961. And I couldn't agree more. It's "In God We Trust" is on our coins. It's on our dollars. It's on postage stamps. In Tennessee, we passed a bill last year. We put it on our license plate. It's part of our national anthem. Why can't we have this in our schools? Of course we can.
It's a great question, but it's amazing to me, given the history of this, going all the way back to the Civil War days when the Congress put this onto the money, and then up into 1956 when the Congress declared it to be the motto of our nation. Has there been any resistance or opposition to this?
I have received a few emails, really more over this past weekend because the bill got a little bit of airtime. But I have received a few very misdirected, misguided, and hateful emails and some voicemails, but they're not from Tennessee. They're not from my district. My district supports this bill at about 86%. The legislators, 81 out of 99, voted for it. And if I can just take a moment to thank my colleagues for voting for this bill, in particular, Representative White, Brooks, Weaver, Gant, and Boyd. They were so helpful and just really helped to usher the bill along, and I'm very grateful.
Well, Tennessee State Representative Susan Lynn, my guest, talking about a bill that has passed the Tennessee legislature, which would simply require that the nation's motto, In God We Trust, which I said is etched above the head of the Speaker in the House of Representatives. It's, as Susan pointed out, it's on our coins, it's on our dollar bills. This would simply say it's on our classroom walls so that the kids understand that there is a higher authority, that that we have purpose and meaning in life. So you're anticipating, Susan, that the governor is going to sign this?
I am. He's a wonderful Christian man. He and his wife are wonderful Christians. We are, I don't think we've ever had a more Christian, a more devout Christian governor in Tennessee. We're really blessed at this time. And I am confident he will sign it. I know the Speaker of the House will sign it. She's a wonderful Christian woman, too. And the Speaker of the Senate has already signed it, and he is a wonderful Christian man. And that's one thing. I hope people don't lose heart. There are really some wonderful Christians in at least in Tennessee state government. There really are. And sure, we have people who fall and make mistakes and all of that. In fact, we have something going on right now. But for the most part, most of the legislators are very strong Christians, and we really think of each other as brothers and sisters in Christ.
Well, Susan, we are we're thrilled for your success there in Tennessee. We appreciate the fact you've advanced this bill. And let me just say this. I do think the Lord did call you to be a missionary. And I think more Christians need to respond to that call and enter into the realm of government. Susan Lynn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for your interest. I thank you so much.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us. And I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.